From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. On this episode, the White House says the economy is recovering, but we'll look at some of the people who have been left out.
I'm looking, and I'm trying to get a job, any job, but currently I don't have a job.
Also, does the Air Force cheating scandal reveal a bigger problem?
I mean, there's a set of incentives here, and the incentives are clearly driving people towards finding shortcuts.
And the amazing story behind the amazing song, Change Is Gonna Come, recorded 50 years ago this week. That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West.
Members of Congress, I have the high privilege and distinct honor of presenting to you the President of the United States.
Last Tuesday night, President Obama stepped up to a podium before Congress and the country, and he declared that the state of our union was strong.
The lowest unemployment rate in over 5 years, a rebounding housing market, a manufacturing sector that's adding jobs for the first time since the 1990s.
Critics quickly pointed out that, of course, things look better if you use the lowest point in the economy, 2009, as the baseline. But the president didn't keep the rose-tinted glasses on for long. Here's the same speech just a few minutes later.
Average wages have barely budged. Inequality has deepened. Upward mobility has stalled. The cold hard fact is that even in the midst of recovery, too many Americans are working more than ever just to get by, let alone to get ahead. And too many still aren't working at all.
And that's our cover story today. The long-term unemployed, the state of the economy, and what can be done. To figure this out, I asked Zanny Minton-Beddoes. She's with The Economist magazine, and she says the president isn't wrong.
Well, I think the U.S. economy is recovering, and it's recovering more rapidly.
There are definitely good signs, Minton-Beddoes says. She points to things like housing sales and the GDP, which grew about 3.5% by the end of last year. Most economists agree that that's the right amount for a healthy economy. Not too fast, not too slow.
That said, there's a lot of very big challenges, and the president pointed them out, right? I mean, you have a lot of people who have been unemployed for a very long time. You have a lot of huge widening in income disparities in this country. You have stagnant social mobility. These are not things that arrived in the few years since the financial crisis. These are very big secular changes that are taking place in the U.S. economy, thanks to new technology, thanks to globalization. And I think now, as we've sort of emerged from the kind of big trough of the crisis and then the very sluggish recovery after it, if indeed the economy is on a more sustainable path of faster recovery, now's the time to turn to these longer-term things.
So Stanford University just released their own State of the Union study. It considers a lot of different points, and they say they found what they call, quote, a broadly deteriorating poverty and inequality landscape. And it seems that everyday Americans agree that their views about the economy are still pretty pessimistic.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think one of the big reasons is that because we have these very big secular changes going on, which are making, you know, income distribution much worse in this country, a lot of the gains of the recovery that we've seen have gone to people at the very top, particularly the very top 1%. And so ordinary people's incomes have not accelerated that much. And so it doesn't seem as though the economy is doing that well. The thing that makes it feel as though the economy is humming for most people is when the labor market is strong.
And one figure that's stuck out to me, this is people aged 25 to 54, the, quote, prime age adults, people who, when in good economic times, about 80% of them are working. At the end of last year, that number was closer to 76%. It doesn't seem like a lot of movement, but that's still 5 million people.
Absolutely. And that's been one of the really striking things about the U.S. economy in the past few years, is that you've seen this very big decline in the share of the labor force that is employed, or the share of people that are employed. Now, partly that is to do with the fact that the population is aging and the baby boomers are aging. And as you get older, fewer people work. But a lot of it probably has to do with the weakness of the recovery itself. And there are people who would like to work but haven't been able to find jobs. And I think you're absolutely right. That is a signal of a weakness in the economy. It's both a sign of the weakness of the recovery, but if you look the other way around, it's also a sign of potential trouble ahead, because the economy's potential is obviously weaker if you've got fewer people working. First of all, in the short term, you have a weaker recovery, right? You have fewer people who have the income and hence the ability to spend. Secondly, you can have some potential long-term effect on the economy, what economists call scarring, which is that the longer people are detached from the labour force, the longer they don't have a job for, the harder it becomes for them to get a job. Their skills don't keep up with what's going on in the workplace. And the more you can really have permanent damage, permanent hit to those people themselves and to the economy's potential.
Zanny Minton-Beddoes of The Economist. We asked the question of ordinary Americans, what is the state of your personal economy? Are you optimistic?
Right now, it's really, really good and stable. I'm able to save money, retirement. I can go out.
It's been hardship after hardship after hardship, and I keep hoping that it's going to get better, but I don't see it changing.
We're not the richest people on the block by any stretch of the imagination, but we're doing okay.
That was Isaac Vega of San Diego, California, Truly Thorne of Salem, Oregon, and Kyle Galley of Worthington, Minnesota. If they sound like they have mixed views, well, that's true of the whole country. Carol Daugherty is the director of political research at the Pew Research Center. Just last week, they released a poll about how Americans are feeling about the economy. While some people reported they're doing well, Daugherty says that the majority have a more pessimistic message.
People are telling us in a lot of ways that they're struggling financially. 57% in our poll say that their family incomes are not keeping up with the cost of living.
And Daugherty says it's remarkable how long the negativity about the economy has lasted.
It's been years since there's been any real substantial improvement in people's feelings about the economy.
Over the last few years, Pew has been asking people where they stand economically. Do they consider themselves upper class, middle class, lower class? And since the start of the recession, there has been one dramatic pattern. More and more people are identifying as lower middle or lower class.
That went up from 25% about 6 years ago to 40% today, so quite a climb.
In other words, a year or two after the recession started, losing your job could be viewed as a temporary setback. You were still middle class. You had a house, a car, a retirement fund. But on the brink of the recession's seventh year, as you've looked for a new job or taken a big pay cut, broken into your savings, struggled with a mortgage, maybe it's time to face the facts and rate yourself a little lower on the economic ladder. Brandy Swanson is one of those people. She's a licensed respiratory therapist and teacher from Conway, Arkansas. She was working 3 12-hour shifts a week at her local hospital, but as the economy tanked, that work dried up. Now?
I'm looking, and I'm trying to get a job, any job, but currently I don't have a job.
Swanson considers herself lucky. Her husband is still employed, and that has helped their family to keep their house and pay the bills. Still, she says, with two kids, expenses continue to pile up.
We've cut corners. We're doing everything we possibly can to save every single dollar just so we can eat and pay our bills and buy gasoline. I don't go out and buy just anything because I want them. We don't go out to eat as much. And that's a big thing. I mean, I used to be able to spend excess money on things like that, and I no longer can. And we have to be really careful. Like, can we really afford that type of meat at the grocery store?
At 40 years old, Brandy Swanson is part of those 5 million prime-aged workers who've been unemployed for a long time. Add to that a new problem. Most new jobs these days pay very well or not very much at all. Jobs with salaries in the middle just aren't returning at the same rate. Of course, that's a great formula for income inequality. According to that same Pew poll, 2/3 of Americans agreed that the gap between the rich and everyone else was growing, but were split on whether the government should be doing anything about it. Again, Carol Daugherty of Pew.
90% of Democrats say it should, and only 45% of Republicans say it should. So on the fundamental question of whether the government should get involved in this issue, there's this huge partisan gap.
But when the poll gets specific about solutions, the answers tell a different story.
73% of Americans, for instance, favor raising the minimum wage. 63% favor increasing long-term unemployment benefits. Those policies are popular. You know, the question is, you know, if implemented, would they have a significant effect on either inequality or poverty?
Certainly the Obama administration thinks both of those things will help the millions of Americans still struggling. Last Tuesday night, Obama urged Congress to pass both those measures and more. On Friday, he went a little further.
The president convened a summit here at the White House, and he used his pen and his phone to do everything he can to help those people get jobs.
Jason Furman is the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, the three White House economists who advise the president. He says Obama has persuaded about 300 companies to end discrimination against the long-term unemployed for new hires. As Zanny Minton-Beddoes of The Economist explained earlier, it could kill the recovery to have millions of people with no job, no income, no way to buy anything or put that money back into the economy. Furman, though, is optimistic. That dropping unemployment rate puts natural pressure on wages to grow, he explains. He says we've already seen it happen a bit.
We can't take for granted, though, that those wage gains are going to happen across the entire income spectrum. And that's why the president on Tuesday night said that he was going to be raising the wages for federal contractors to $10.10 an hour. And he'd like to see businesses, localities, states, and most importantly, the federal government through legislation by Congress follow through.
At the same time, and you can read between the lines there, President Obama really can't do that much on his own. Long-term unemployment insurance has taken a back seat in both chambers. Prospects don't look good for the $10.10 minimum wage bill either. And as much as the president can ask companies to help out the long-term unemployed, there simply aren't enough jobs for the millions who would like one. While Congress and the president search for solutions, Brandi Swanson and her family are settling into their new reality.
I think that my family is learning how to survive in the economy now. If I'm lucky and I get a job at a living wage, not minimum wage, but a living wage, then I think that the recovery may be possible. I might be able to see that light. But if I don't get a job, then no.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Arun Roth. Even now, decades after the end of the Cold War, the United States maintains a big nuclear arsenal. At any given moment, 24 hours a day, American service members remain on alert, on land, sea, and air, ready, if the order comes, to drop bombs or launch missiles that could each annihilate a city. This week, the Pentagon announced that 92 Air Force officers, service members who keep watch on the country's nuclear missiles, have been suspended. The charge? Involvement with cheating on monthly proficiency exams.
I guess I believe now that we do have systemic problems within the force.
That's Air Force Secretary Deborah Lee James at a press conference this week. She's been visiting Air Force crews around the country, talking with the service members known as missileers.
I heard repeatedly that the need for perfection has created a climate of undue stress and fear. Fear about the future, fear about promotions, fear about what will happen to them in their careers.
All of the suspended officers come from just one base, Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana. And that means almost half of all the officers at that base have been suspended. That gives you a sense of how few people actually do this work.
Your job is basically to monitor the 10 nuclear missiles that you are in charge of. If there's maintenance going on at those sites or at your location, you're supervising that. And that workload can range from a lot going on to not a lot.
Brian Whedon is a former Air Force officer who served at Malmstrom in the early 2000s. He says the monthly exams can be extremely difficult, requiring hours and hours of memorization. A good result, he says, is a perfect score. Passing means getting a 90. Brian Whedon says he started to question the value of his work when he served on alert in charge of 10 nuclear missiles during the terrorist attacks on 9/11.
We were doing a job where we were told, if you do this job well and you're really proficient, you will deter attacks against America and help keep America safe. And what we saw on that morning, what I saw, was we had failed in that job. And that, in me, evoked a combination of frustration and anger. In my mind, part of what we're seeing with the change in the culture in the nuclear world is there's a discontinuity between what the leadership says is reality and what the people actually see as reality. What they're saying is reality is the nuclear force is just as important as it has always been, and therefore it is just as important for you to be as prepared, as proficient, and as vigilant. But what I saw, and I know that others I've talked to that do the job have seen, is that the nuclear force and the nuclear deterrent is not as important as it once was.
When you heard about the cheating scandal involving the current group of missileers, what was your reaction?
any discussion about this issue has to revolve around how people define the word cheating, because there's a spectrum there. On one end, you have, here's all the answers. Everybody, I think, agrees that that is obviously cheating.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other end of the spectrum are things like, well, watch out for question 9 this month. It's a trick question. Or you go to turn in your test, and somebody might say, why don't you go back and double-check question number 20? That, some people would consider cheating, some people would not.
By most academic standards, though, wouldn't that be considered, like, you know, I just know from the last time I was in college and taking, you know, say, a yep. biology test, that that would definitely be considered
absolutely
not and acceptable.
So, yes. Now, when I was in, I was not aware of any situation where people were sharing entire answers to tests. But there was certainly a significant amount of that other end of the spectrum going on, of hints, tips, maybe intelligence about tests. Not everybody was doing it, but just about everybody was aware that it was going on. So when these revelations came out, when I first heard about them, myself and everyone else who'd done the job, we were not surprised. And actually what took us by surprise was the initial reaction by the leadership that this is new and this is just a few bad apples. And I think what's interesting is over the last several weeks, we've seen the leadership's position on that change. And now they're talking about how, yes, we should have seen this coming. This is a cultural thing that needs to be corrected.
So how does that get going? I mean, if that was even there in your time, where, again, it does, in terms of what you consider academic cheating, even the tips are cheating as much as it is to get a full set of answers.
I mean, I've talked to people that have done the job as far back as the 1970s. And through those that have done it after me. And what I've seen is over time, a increase in the pressure put on people to be perfect. There's been a progression over time where they're using the test scores for things other than just measuring proficiency. You know, they're determining who gets promotions and who gets hired into instructor evaluator positions. That can determine careers. At the same time, people are seeing that the value of what they're doing is not what it once was. I mean, there's a set of incentives here. And the incentives are clearly driving people towards finding shortcuts.
And Brian, I don't want to linger on this point uncomfortably, but I just want to be clear. Sure. You were among those who cheated on these tests, right?
Well, again, it goes back to defining how you define cheating. In the career field, when you come into the field, you're known as what's called a deputy. Right, you're just learning the job, and you have a crew partner, a commander assigned to you who's been in the job for at least a year and a half, is much more experienced. For the first couple of months when I had a new deputy, before they turned in their test, I would look it over for them, and I would tell them to go back and look at ones that I knew they'd gotten wrong. That was to help them get on their feet. Now, some people might consider that to be cheating, but in my mind, the penalties for them screwing up that early test over the course of the next 3-4 years of their career far outweighed any ethical violation that I had in doing that.
That was Brian Whedon. He is no longer with the Air Force, but served for 4 years as a missileer. Brian says he is hopeful that the Air Force is working to not just discipline officers, but to change the culture among those who keep watch on the nuclear arsenal. Drug-related deaths are scarring families and communities across the country. The area around Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been hit especially hard. 22 people have died there in less than 2 weeks, the latest in a wave of heroin overdoses. Police in western Pennsylvania are blaming the deaths on an especially potent form of the street drug. After testing, they determined the heroin had been mixed with a prescription painkiller known as fentanyl.
Fentanyl is very potent. It can be 70 to 100 times more powerful than morphine.
That's Dr. Neil Capretto. He's the medical director at the Gateway Rehabilitation Center in Pittsburgh. He says dealers have stamped the drug with a street name, Theraflu. Dr. Capretto says that is no accident.
Well, what does the product Theraflu treat? Flu symptoms, cold symptoms. What does going through opioid or heroin withdrawal feel like? It feels like a very bad case of the flu multiplied times 10. They call it dope sickness. So it's basically marketing. We will treat your withdrawal symptoms if you're, quote, dope sick with this Theraflu. You know, drug dealers compete with one another to get new customers. At first, it may not seem to make sense. Why would they now have this product so potent that some of their customers are dying. Isn't it bad for business? But as some of my patients told me, a dealer may be willing to lose 4 or 5 customers through an overdose death to attract, you know, 30 or 40 new customers, and they call that the cost of doing business. When people start hearing of people dying from overdoses, logic would say stay away from that stuff. It's dangerous. People with addiction hear it, and particularly heroin addiction, and they think that's the strong stuff, that's the good stuff, and they chase it. And, of course, they don't want to die. They think, I want to push the high to the edge, and I'm going to be more careful than the last person who died, but they very well may be the next person who dies.
Do you have a sense of why this drug is hitting the streets now and in your area?
Well, first of all, we have an epidemic of heroin in western Pennsylvania, and this is true in a lot of cities throughout the country. There's more heroin being used than at any time in our history. I mean, historically, heroin used to be thought of as mainly an inner-city drug. That has dramatically changed, particularly over the last 10 years. Heroin now, at least in our area, is in every town, community. It's become more of a drug of middle, upper-middle-class Caucasian families. And a lot of this has been fueled by the prescription medicine epidemic. I call this the perfect storm. We started in the late 90s with a big emphasis on better treatment of pain, which we absolutely have to treat. But that fueled physicians starting to write much more larger amounts of pain medicines. I've treated myself thousands of people addicted to OxyContin and similar drugs. What ends up happening, these people are from the small towns, the rural communities. They can no longer afford their prescription medicines. And then somebody tells them, hey, you can keep yourself from getting sick or get a similar feeling with this new heroin that started coming out. Then they became new heroin customers.
As we've been covering this new rise of heroin on this program, we've come across advocates who have called for states to pass what they call Good Samaritan laws, so that people who call in when there's an overdose don't risk being arrested themselves. Does Pennsylvania have that law?
We do not. We are trying to get one. They're a very good idea. The sad thing is the majority of people who die from a drug overdose, there's somebody with them. And in a majority of cases, people do not call 911. Because they're afraid. They're afraid if authorities come that they'll get arrested because they're also using drugs. The Good Samaritan law will say if you call in good faith, you will not be arrested for just simply using or have drug paraphernalia. There's legislation pending in Pennsylvania. I really think it should be a national standard.
Do you think you've seen the worst of the heroin epidemic in your area?
Unfortunately, no. We've had an epidemic. I mean, this has been building up since the mid to late 90s. You know, in Allegheny County, Pittsburgh area, through the 1980s, we averaged around 55, 58 drug overdose deaths a year. That's a lot of people. In 2012, the last year we have statistics, we set a record of 288 drug overdose deaths. And unfortunately, I still see this as getting worse before it gets better. I mean, this Theraflu thing is a crisis, but we've had a crisis. This is just a kind of spike upward in a crisis that's been ongoing. If the Theraflu goes away, we still have a major problem with heroin and prescription drugs in our community, and we can't forget that.
That's Dr. Neil Capretto. He's the medical director at Gateway Rehabilitation Center in Pittsburgh. Dr. Capretto, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Great composers have tantalized us by leaving behind unfinished works. Schubert's Eighth Symphony, Mozart's Requiem, and Duke Ellington's opera, Queenie Pie. That's right, Ellington was writing what he hoped would be a great American street opera, but he couldn't finish it before he died in 1974. Since then, composers have adapted the work to try to figure out what the Duke wanted. NPR's Priska Neely reports on the complicated history of Queenie Pie.
Before you imagine soothing arias or boisterous trills in vibrato, let me stop you. Duke Ellington's opera is very much jazz. The opera has been performed only a handful of times over the decades. Karen Marie Richardson plays the lead character, Queenie Pie, in the latest production put on by the Long Beach Opera.
The minute that Queenie Pie has her first solo, which is a scat, people are caught off guard, you know, good or bad, but they're caught off guard by hearing a scat as opposed to what they think might be possibly a cadenza.
The opera tells the story of Queenie Pie, a Harlem beautician voted the best in town for years on end, until she is challenged by a lighter-skinned woman named Cafe Olé.
I can certainly see why the pageant has honored you as runner-up. Your complexion is so light.
The production is, in part, a commentary on colorism.
It almost looks natural.
What is natural? I'm Creole.
But of course, there's a love triangle. In this scene, Cafe Olé and Queenie argue over the same man using no words at all. Okay, spoiler alert. Cafe Olé kills the lover in a fit of rage. And in the second act, Queenie Pie retreats to a magical island. Those main plot points, the rivalry, the murder, the island, have remained the same over the decades. But a lot of other things have changed. The story of this production goes all the way back to the 1930s. That's when Duke Ellington had the idea to write a musical about Madame C.J. Walker, the black millionaire who made her fortune from hair and beauty products. Fast forward to the 1960s. New York's public TV station commissioned Ellington for an hour-long TV opera. Even after that project lost funding, he didn't let Queenie Pie go. In his final years, Ellington really started to focus on it, collaborating with writers on the plot and libretto. But when he died in 1974, it was still incomplete.
Because he never finished it, I see the current productions, every one to follow as well, evolving and getting closer toward what Ellington wanted. I think that's really our goal.
Mark Bolan is the man who revived the work for the 21st century. Queenie Pie was pieced together for performances in the 1980s and 90s, but those scores weren't preserved. So in 2007, Bolan began a treasure hunt to find the pieces of this largely forgotten work. The Smithsonian Museum had some elements, including hotel napkins with scribbles from Ellington. The library at UC Irvine had some pieces, but still, only descriptions of the characters, and only about half the orchestration.
It's almost like starting with a sentence and then creating a chapter of a book, you know.
Bolan says there were some songs that were mostly finished.
It was All Hail the Queen, and it was this kind of a fanfare, very fanfare kind of thing. That was mostly in place.
In other cases, Bolan had just a few measures to start with, little pieces of melody that he fully orchestrated. The Oakland Opera Theater used his arrangement in 2008. That adaptation has been the guide for the couple of productions since, including the Long Beach Opera performance that opened here in Southern California last weekend. On opening night, the theater was full and the audience transfixed. Here's Annette Berry.
You could feel Duke's legacy, his spirit, in the music.
And Mark Sklan.
Everything captured all that folks love about Duke Ellington. This really felt complete.
Charlene Baldridge writes reviews for Opera News. She thinks the production is still a work in progress.
It's got a long way to go to coalesce into something that flows. Right now it's pieces, and they're wonderful pieces, but they're not a show by any means.
For this production, the show was adapted yet again. The director, Ken Rote, tweaked the tone and plot to put colorism more on center stage. Mark Bolan says it's been quite a journey watching his adaptation change.
It's been mostly pleasant, and in some places, there's been growing pains, too, because I've become so attached to it. When it comes down to it, I'm just very excited to see the opera being performed and produced.
Bolan gave a talk before the opening night of this Long Beach opera show. He told the audience that this project is like a batch of sourdough bread.
You've got this little germ of a bread, and you never get rid of the initial germ, but you can make tons of different loaves.
This production will move to the Chicago Opera Theater February 15th through March 5th. And who knows where that germ will go next. Priska Neely, NPR News.
Today, a silent film, a 13-minute comedy, introduced a new performer to movie audiences. The film was called Making a Living, and critic Bob Mondello says that it left some doubt as to whether its star would be able to do just that. His name? Charles Spencer Chaplin.
Silent film mogul Mack Sennett, who invented the Keystone Cops, is said to have barely cracked a smile when he first saw Making a Living on screen, watching the 24-year-old British comic he'd hired for the princely sum of $150 a week. He figured he'd made an expensive mistake. This Chaplin kid, playing a swindler in top hat, monocle, and handlebar mustache, was trying too hard, waving his arms around, laughing. He wasn't funny. Turns out there was a reason. Chaplin complained that director Henry Lerman had cut all the swindler's best gags. Lerman was also playing the film's other male lead, and he later admitted he'd taken an instant dislike to the smart-alecky newcomer and mishandled his scenes out of spite. Both of them begged Sennett to let them work with other people, but films got made so fast in those days that before the week was out, they'd already made two more together. Happily, by the third, which was released just 5 days after Making a Living, Chaplin had found his comic footing. It was called Kid Auto Races at Venice, an improvised quickie shot in just 45 minutes without a script to take advantage of an event they'd read about in the morning papers, a children's soapbox derby. The joke? They filmed themselves filming, with Chaplin playing a camera hog who keeps getting between the film crew and the kids in their homemade cars. Lerman keeps pushing him away, and Charlie keeps sneaking back into the frame, wearing a shabby costume he'd grabbed in a rush on the way out of the studio. No monocle and top hat this time. Now he's got shoes that are too big, a derby that's too small, baggy pants, tight coat, cheap bamboo cane, all of which makes the character look poor, down on his luck, a tramp. And on the faces in the crowd, you can see, before a single frame of film has been developed, that audiences get him. Chaplin pretends to be nonchalant, innocent, as he slyly gets in everybody's way, and a few kids in the crowd start to watch him instead of the race. Then, just as you will, they start to grin, and soon they're laughing and pointing, captivated by this little guy who seems as drawn to the camera as it is to him, little knowing they're watching the birth of a 20th century icon, the Little Tramp, who would soon, and for decades to come, be the most recognized and the most beloved figure on the planet. I'm Bob Mondello.
I'm sorry, I usually get a snack during commercials. I thought they turned my microphone down. Of course, that's not me. That's the crunch of Doritos. Recognize it now? You've heard it in countless Doritos commercials.
Kind of sounds like Godzilla eating chips. It's pretty big.
That's sound designer and composer Steven Baber. He created that signature crunch.
It's a very loud, loud, multi-layered crunch that was me eating two bags of Doritos.
For the past decade, Baber has been creating peculiar sounds and writing music with a group of sound designers he founded. They call themselves Johnny Random. Their music is all over the place, like in this Adidas commercial. But last summer, Baber wanted to produce something more personal. But where to find that unique personal sound? Baber is not someone who can just sit down at the piano and write a tune. That's too easy. He took his specialty microphones and set them on a very unusual instrument.
I wanted to just document every single sound you could possibly get out of a bike.
That's right, a bicycle. But this was about more than just weird sounds.
I wanted it to be beautiful. I wanted to capture it in a way that translated well into musical composition.
Baber took two bikes, one mountain bike and one road bike, and he got to work with his microphones. There was the kind of obvious stuff.
A lot of the most mechanical, recognizable sounds, like pedaling and gears turning, the brake calipers snapping back into place.
Or letting the air out of the tubes. Or running a guitar pick along a spinning tire. Then there was the more creative stuff, like taking a violin bow to the spokes on a wheel. Like any stringed instrument, the bicycle can be fussy.
For instance, when you pluck a spoke on a wheel, you're not just hearing one, you're hearing all of them. They all ring out from sympathetic vibration. So the way to solve that was to tune every single spoke to the exact same pitch, which takes forever.
An hour of tuning per pitch, to be exact. So Baber says he collected thousands of sounds, different parts of the bike, different takes, and he took all of those raw elements, processed them, filtered them, and made them groove. This is Bespoken, the track that Baber put up on iTunes under the name Johnny Random. He knew the concept could have been a hard sell.
When you first tell people you made a piece of music from bikes, they're not exactly eager to hit play.
But after months and months of work, it's safe to say the song has gone viral, featured on dozens of websites, and shared countless times online. And that means Stephen Baber, a.k.a. Johnny Random, has his eyes on some new instruments.
Well, I'm currently tearing apart my kitchen. My focus next is the entire kitchen.
Once again, thanks for listening. This is All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. When times are rough, a lot of people have a list of things they know without fail remind them that life is wonderful. Sam Cooke is so high on my list.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
If that doesn't give you the chills, there might be something wrong with you. Sam Cooke recorded A Change Is Gonna Come 50 years ago this week. The story of the song is as amazing and unsettling as the song itself. The first thing you should know about A Change Is Gonna Come, it is unlike anything else Sam Cooke ever recorded. Biographer Peter Guralnick.
His first success came with the song You Send Me. I mean, this was his first crossover number under his own name, and it went to number one on the pop charts, which was just unheard of. But as he evolved as a pop singer, he brought more and more of his gospel background into his music, as well as his social awareness, which was keen. But really, A Change Is Gonna Come was a real departure for him in the sense that it was undoubtedly the first time that he addressed social problems in a direct and explicit way.
It's hard to imagine today what it meant for a black artist to achieve crossover in 1963. It did not come easily. And the last thing Sam Cooke wanted was to alienate his new audience. But he came out of the gospel world. He could not ignore moral outrage right in front of him. Then he was jarred by another civil rights anthem, this one written by Bob Dylan.
The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
And his reaction to it was that it was such a good song, but it was a song that a person of color should have written, that he should have written. And he incorporated it into his repertoire almost from the time he first heard it.
What I want to know is how many times can a man turn his head
pretending that he just doesn't see. Oh, the answer, my friend, blowing in the wind. The answer, blowing in the wind.
It was also impossible for Sam Cooke to avoid affronts to his personal dignity. In the fall of 1963, he was turned away from a Holiday Inn in Shreveport, Louisiana.
He just went off, and he refused to leave. He became obstreperous to the point where his wife, Barbara, said, Sam, we better get out of here. They're going to kill you. And he says, they're not going to kill me. I'm Sam Cooke.
Wow.
To which his wife said, no, to them, you're just another, you know. Mm. And Sam got arrested, was put in jail for disturbing the peace, along with several of his company. And I think both the indignity of this and his anger, I think that was really as direct a cause of his writing the song, which he wrote within the next month or two, as anything else.
I go to the movie and I go downtown. Somebody keep telling me don't hang around.
It was less work than any song he'd ever written. It came to him almost whole, despite the fact that in many ways it's probably the most complex song that he wrote, because it was both singular in the sense that you start out, I was born by the river, but it also told the story both of a generation and of a people.
Then I go to my brother and I say, brother, help me please. But he winds up knocking me back down on my knees.
Oh. Sam Cooke was a brilliant musician and a bit of a control freak. He knew exactly how he wanted every instrument to sound. But for this track, he gave total latitude to the arranger, Renee Hall.
And Renee Hall was sort of taken aback that Sam was turning the song over to him. But he took the charge seriously, and he wrote what was essentially a symphonic arrangement. Each verse is a different movement. The strings have their movement, the horns have their movement, the timpani carries the bridge. It was like a movie score. He wanted it to have a grandeur to it.
Oh, there have been times that I thought I could last for long, but now I think I'm able to carry on.
Sam Cooke believed this was the best song he had ever written. A Change Is Gonna Come was released on the album Ain't That Good News in March of 1964. The civil rights movement picked up on it immediately, but most of his audience did not, mostly because it wasn't selected as one of the first singles and because Sam Cooke only played the song before a live audience once.
It was a complex arrangement with something like 17 strings, but the other part was that it had this kind of ominousness about it. When he first played it for Bobby Womack, who was his protege, Bobby said, sounds like death.
It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die.
And Sam said, man, that's kind of how it sounds like to me. That's why I'm never going to play it in public. And Bobby sort of rethought it and said, well, that's not like death, but it sounds kind of spooky.
What happened afterward was more than spooky. Just before the song was to be released as a single in December of 1964, Sam Cooke would be shot to death at a motel in Los Angeles. A Change Is Gonna Come is now much more than a civil rights anthem. It doesn't age. It's become a universal message of hope.
Generation after generation has heard the promise of it. It continues to be a song of enormous impact, and the idea that a change is gonna come was taken by President Obama in Grant Park the night of his election.
It's been a long time coming, but tonight, because of what we did on this day, in this election, at this defining moment, change has come to America.
It's been a long time coming, but I know change gonna come.
We all feel, in some way or another, that a change is gonna come, and he found that lyric. It was the kind of hook that he always looked for, the phrase that was both familiar but was striking enough so it would have its own originality. And that makes it almost endlessly adaptable to whatever goal, whatever movement is of the moment.
That was biographer Peter Guralnick talking about Sam Cooke's A Change Is Gonna Come, which was recorded 50 years ago this week. Guralnick's book is called Dream Boogie, The Triumph of Sam Cooke. For the week ending February 2nd, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Becky Sullivan, Daniel Hajek, and Francesca Fenzi. Our intern is Stephen Jackson. Patrick Murray is our technical director, with technical support from Marcia Caldwell and Leo Dell'Aquila. Muthoni Muturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week, and remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.